Hello everyone, welcome to Bookomi. I'm Rich Kilgariff. Now, a long time ago in a London far, far away, I did a Books for Breakfast event at Soho House with the neuroscientist, musician, educator and best-selling author Daniel Levitin, a proper polymath. He's recorded with David Byrne and Sting, consulted on albums by Joni Mitchell, Steely Dan, and also on the soundtracks to Good Will Hunting and Pulp Fiction. His best-selling books include the groundbreaking Your Brain on Music, The Organized Mind and The Changing Mind. He's an accomplished academic, and he's currently the Dean of Arts and Humanities at a progressive new university called Minerva Schools in San Francisco. Their mission is to open up a diverse higher education for people from all nations and backgrounds. So when I asked him to choose a book from our most wanted list at bookomi.com, he was drawn to a title written by a young man who wants his generation to challenge inequality in society today, tomorrow, and forever. Take it away, Dan.
Hi, my name is Daniel Levitin. The one I am choosing is Dreaming in a Nightmare by Jeremiah Emanuel, an activist. I chose this because it's a story of two worlds, one where violence is everywhere, and the other where the sky's the limit, and how it's possible to move from one to the other. It's a topic that is very important to me in that, as an educator, it is pretty obvious that intellect is not concentrated among the wealthy. Ability and conscientiousness and drive and problem solving and creativity don't just exist where the money is. And yet an enormous part of humanity are being left out of the kinds of educational opportunities that would not only help them but make the world a better place. So I want to read what Jeremiah Emanuel has to say about this.
Before he was 10 years old, Jeremiah Emanuel was campaigning on all the issues that affected his friends, and in 2011 he was elected to the UK Youth Parliament and later became a young mayor within London. At 15, he founded the BBC Radio 1 and One Extra Youth Council, creating a youth consultancy enterprise, EMNL, which has worked with organisations including Rolls-Royce, Nike and the Queen's Commonwealth Trust. He is also a member of the Gates Foundation, a youth ambassador for the Big Change Charitable Trust, and in 2017, he was awarded a British Empire Medal. This episode of the Bookomi podcast was recorded in front of a live audience at Shoreditch House in London on the publication day for Jeremiah's first book,
Dreaming in a Nightmare, Inequality and What We Can Do About It. Jeremiah, welcome to Bookomi.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. And thank you everyone in the audience for coming down.
It's nice to see everyone, isn't it?
Yeah. It's just surreal that everything has sort of been virtually based and now we're in person. So yeah, it feels really good to be here.
You can retire after all that. That's quite a list of achievements, isn't it? For someone who thought they weren't going to make 20.
Yeah, it's still a long way to go. You know, I'm so passionate about the work that I do with young people across the whole of the UK. And yeah, just privileged and honoured to be able to put this book out to the whole entire world so everyone can learn about my story.
Well, it is an amazing story. What are you most proud of along the way? That list of achievements there. I mean, someone who was three or four times your age would be happy with that. What are you most proud of so far?
I think it was probably when I was named an honours list. And this was something that was so like alien to me because I had known about honours and titles and all of that. But to think that I would be recognised or to have pronominals or whatever, I would never ever think it would happen. So I think it was the shock at 17, you know, becoming the youngest black person in Britain to be honoured. And I sort of made it my responsibility moving forward to ensure that I can inspire and motivate people, especially from my community, to do great things.
But the book's been ready to be published for a while now. I mean, you've almost doubled in age since then. But the serious point is the world's changed.
Yeah.
I mean, talking about the issues in the book that you deal with, the world has changed, but it's changed, but everything's still the same.
Yeah.
You know, not least COVID-19, but also, you know, the murder of George Floyd, the reemergence of Black Lives Matter.
Yeah.
How have you changed? How did you change in writing the book? And how has your perspective changed in the last 6 months?
Yeah, well, Actually, the majority of the book was completed by the beginning of this year. But what is so shocking and surprising for me is that something I would have written in 2019 is very relevant now. And many of the things that are happening currently sort of link into the book. So the overarching message of the book is, you know, how can we create a more equal society within the UK? You know, I touch on many topics that sort of build up into inequality as a whole. And even, you know, in a world post COVID-19 and during the lockdown, I saw how the community where I grew up was like massively affected. You know, I never actually had to live in like a high rise estate block, but I knew many young people who just were actually locked away and no green spaces and the lack of opportunities, and some young people that, you know, their parents couldn't even afford Wi-Fi or internet, so they were practically left doing nothing for months. So yeah, a lot of the things that I talk about in the book, you know, I didn't want to really turn it into a fact checker around COVID-19 and stuff. But yeah, many of the issues that we talk about are very relevant today. And again, in an interview the other day, I sort of said, does the nightmare ever stop? And that was a question that I still haven't been able to answer myself.
Well, I think just a lot more people got sucked into the nightmare, didn't they? And talking of the nightmare language, we'll get onto the details of that in a second, but how would you define that nightmare? You define it more in the book as a state of mind.
Yeah, yeah. So the title of the book, Dreaming in a Nightmare, I felt that sort of encapsulated my life growing up. And, you know, I grew up in Brixton, South London, very desensitized from a number of different issues that me, my family and friends were going through. You know, I start the book off by talking about homelessness, something that my family was affected by for like nearly half my life, and we were hidden homeless. So within the first 7 years of my life, I had moved about seven times, and I felt like I was like always on a run without an explanation as to why. You know, I delve into like poverty. You know, I come from like a low income background family. I touch on violent crime, the justice system. So the nightmare itself isn't down to geographical location. You know, it isn't saying if you grew up in Brixton, you're living in a nightmare. And it also isn't saying that I recognize my life as a nightmare. To me, it was the realization that my reality could be perceived as a nightmare. And it wasn't until I started traveling the world, you know, doing quite well within the world of business, you know, Richard, we've spoken about some of the people that I've worked with, and we would just always have like conversations, and when we would converse around several different topics and I would share my experiences to everyone, you know, they were horrified at some of my experiences. You know, some of the feedback I would receive is, you know, a kid should have never experienced what you had to experience, or should have never witnessed some of the things you had to witness. And that was a wake-up call to me, to the fact that your reality could be perceived as a nightmare. And I think the other thing to touch on, you know, is the fact that I touch on two alternative views. One being that your reality could be seen as a dream. And it wasn't until I went on a trip with an organization called 2.org. A great friend of mine, Naxon Mimran, is the co-founder. And he had invited me and a few other influencers over to Senegal for Naomi Campbell's birthday.
As you did. And
within that sort of like week, we... following Naomi's like birthday, we went around to like loads of different NGOs and organizations and charities. And on one of the particular days, the group had gone to like a waste dump, and there was a young woman, a mother, who had like a 6-month-old wrapped around her back, and she was going through all of this, you know, plastic waste from the West, and sort of upcycling materials to provide for her family. And I remember sort of being in discussion about that and thinking, you know, even though my life has been the way it's been, the fact that I did have a roof over my head, I did have access to clean water, I did have a free education and healthcare, people would die to be in that position. And the second alternative view was when I sat down in the Conduit with two friends who are a really wealthy couple, and they were sharing a story about when they had dinner with a friend. And he was sort of going through this almost, I would say, like midlife crisis, and speaking to them about all of the things going wrong within his life, talking about his family, talking about being in the process of a divorce. And he sort of broke down around the dinner table, sort of saying, you know, you guys are worth multi-millions of dollars. You know, you've got your estates, you've got your cars. They had a really successful safari business. And he was naming all of these things. And he was like, look at the problems I'm having with my kids, you know, and my wife. And one of the two of them actually turned around to him and said, well, for the past 5 years we've been married, we've been trying for kids, and that is something that hasn't been able to happen for us. And if we could have the joy of just having kids, we would almost like drop everything that we have, like this is meaningless to us. And when they shared that to me, you know, we were discussing how even though they could be seen as living the dream, they were also living in their own version of a nightmare. So again, the nightmare element, everyone has their own nightmare. And again, it's the fact that I realized that my reality, what I thought was the norm, all of the problems that I was desensitized from, they were seen as a complete nightmare.
Yeah, it's all relative in the end, isn't it? And that perspective that you've been given leads to lots of tension and a paradox, really, because you... We ran through your list of accomplishments there, one of which, you know, is the British Empire Medal. And you've almost become part of the establishment that you was holding you back when you were growing up. You know, an education system that teaches kids from lower income groups to how to get a job to work for someone.
Yeah.
A British Empire that encouraged immigrants to come to the country. And then by the Commonwealth Act in 62... decides that they're not allowed to be citizens of the same country they're invited to come and work in.
Yeah.
And you've grown up in that tension.
Yeah. And
how do you square that with yourself? You know, rubbing shoulders in all different levels in part of the system maybe that you want to pull down.
Yeah. So in terms of the system itself, I wouldn't say that I want to pull it down, but I would say that I just want us to become a more equal society. And there's loads of debate around like the honours list and its connotations, the British Empire and stuff. But to me, you know, I was a 17-year-old from Brixton, you know, who had a lack of opportunities, and one day went home to a letter from the head of the civil service saying that the Prime Minister wanted to nominate my name to the Queen. And as someone who grew up where I was from, you know, this was something that was unheard of, something that never happens to any of us, I would say. And at that moment, I felt it was my responsibility to accept this award, to show everyone from where I'm from that they can be whatever they want to be, they can go to whatever place they want to go to. And again, within the book, you know, I touch on the fact that inequality is something that sort of thrives within our society. I talk about my first interaction with a bus route. The 345 bus route. Has anyone taken a 345 before? So it sort of starts in Peckham and it ends in South Kensington.
I didn't know we were going to talk about this today, so I'm going with you on this one.
Yeah, so in terms of the 345, I used to be part of this community choir, and we would go into the Royal Brompton Hospital and several other like intensive care units across London to like sing carols at Christmas. So back in the day, my voice was a lot higher, soprano, like I could actually sing. It broke. I lost my voice. But anyway, you know, I remember getting on the bus for the first time. And it sort of started in Brixton, the place I was used to being in. You know, the pavements were dirty, graffiti everywhere, these old estate blocks, police sirens up and down the road, litter on the pavements. And I remember getting onto the bus and going through Clapham, a place I was still familiar with. And then from Clapham, we went over to the other side of Clapham. And as we were passing through, it sort of felt like this weird different place. And then we crossed the bridge over to Kensington and Chelsea after going through Battersea. And by the time I got to Chelsea, the pavement looked the exact same colour as it was the day it was paved. You know, there was no litter in sight. And at the same time, I couldn't even see a bin in sight. So it was so confusing, because in Brixton, there's about 10 bins up and down like the high street, and you will still find litter on the floor. And then I was seeing all of these supercars that I had only seen in Fast and Furious, and all of these massive houses. And at that moment, I actually came to realize that within this society, communities are so close but far away. And when I came to actually writing the book, and I thought about many young people from my community, I had to ask myself, in terms of like meeting people from middle to upper classes, when does that interaction happen? And there was three things that stood out to me. One, you know, if you get into Oxbridge, you're definitely gonna meet people from a different background. If you get into a Ross Group University, it might also be the case. The second thing was, you know, if you go into the corporate world or into like a profession, a preferred profession, I would put them, your boss probably would come from like a different sort of background. And the third stark reality of it was the fact that the majority of young people only meet, well, not the majority, because not all of them fall on the wrong side of the law, but for the ones that do, their only interaction with someone from a different background is in a courtroom, when they're meeting the judge for the first time and they're getting their verdict and getting sentenced. And that for me was shocking, that rich and poor communities up and down the country just live in parallel lines. And it was something I only came to realize when I started working in the world of business and I would meet different people. You know, Grenfell was a prime example. I had some of my friends and colleagues and clients who lived within that sort of area saying, you know, it's shocking what's happened. We want to like help the community. We went down to volunteer and all of that. And then I had an alternative view of young people who had grown up around that estate, who were engaged with one of our Nike projects. And they had an alternative view. And for me, it's how can we break down this wall of silence that we have between different communities? You know, there's an example of a school in East London called Brampton Manor. They've been in the news a lot because they've worked really, really well to, getting like a lot of their kids places in Oxbridge, excellent A-level results. And one of the programs they do is that they collaborate with a private school and a boarding school, and their students go over to that school to spend some time, and the students from a private school go and spend time at Brampton Manor. And just that experience, you know, being in a different setting, having access to a similar but quite different curriculum in the way that subjects are being taught, you know, that for me was like a great example of really breaking down that wall of silence.
So who is the book for? Because, you know, there's a danger these days that we just talk to our own group of people in our echo chambers.
Yeah.
You have a very direct voice in the book. You know, I felt like you were talking to the reader, but I felt like the reader you were talking to was somebody who needs to get to grips with their identity first and foremost. Maybe someone in a similar situation to you in a nightmare, maybe not the same nightmare, but, you know, living that state of mind nightmare. How did you come to terms with your identity? Because you, through writing the book or through thinking about it, you got to know your mum a bit better, didn't you?
Yeah.
In knowing where she had grown up in bizarre circumstances compared to the circumstances she found herself in. How did you get to know her a bit better? Tell us a bit about your mum.
Yeah. First, to sort of touch on audience, there was two main audiences that I had thought about in terms of the book. You know, I thought, how can this relate to a young person from where I'm from, and how can someone like, I don't know, Richard Branson, who I've interacted with, how could someone like Richard read the book and understand all of these underlying issues that are happening within society? So again, examples of two very different people, but for me it was number one to inspire young people from where I'm from to understand that they can find a way forward in a world that's holding them back, but also to someone who might not have had the exact same upbringing as myself. You know, a lot of these questions are for those people too. And in fact, even going into identity, I believe identity is very important. And as we live our lives and go forward, a lot of the times, you know, you have to ask the question, you know, do we really know ourselves? And that's a very important thing that I've touched on. I use the example of my own identity. And throughout this book journey, I connected with my mum on a deeper level, you know, when it came to interviewing her and learning about her upbringing. I really didn't know half of the things that she had actually educated me about, told me about, to do with her upbringing and family. So that was very important for me. You know, one thing I talk about is the fact that, of course, I identify as British. I was born here. I've never stepped foot in Nigeria my whole entire life. It's the top of my to-do list now that I've written this book. But the one thing that I never understood is when I would meet people, it might even be amongst friends, or it might not even be someone who might not be able to relate to my upbringing. The question that is always asked is, where are you from? And for me, identifying as British, I've always thought, well, I'm English. I was born in England. But for some reason, it's just an automatic thing to say where your parents or your grandparents are from. And that was something that I never sort of understood, because I felt, you know, I was born in the UK, Croydon University Hospital. So, of course, I'm British. And it's the flip side in the States. Because when you go to the States and you go up to like a young African-American and you say, where are you from? They'll say, well, I'm African-American. So they wouldn't actually say, oh, well, my ancestors or my great grandparent, or even if their parents from a different country, they wouldn't say that. They'll just say I'm African-American. So there was something about that sort of area that I didn't understand. But my message, especially to sort of like the older generation that would interact with this book, you know, on the Virgin Strive Challenge, which is this like incredible adventurous challenge with like philosophers, entrepreneurs, philanthropists from all over the world. We go on this challenge to raise money for Big Change, which is educational charity that is very close to my heart. I'm an ambassador for them. And I had the opportunity to speak in front of like Richard Branson, in front of Sarah Blakely, the founder of Spanx, Morten Albeck, who's a really successful entrepreneur from Denmark, and a few other people. And the message that I said to them at that moment, which was about 2 years ago, is I had felt like I had only reached about 3% of my full potential. And I felt that I had a long way to go. Maybe now I might say with a book, maybe like 10% of my potential now. But at that moment in time, I told them 3%. And I turned around to everyone and said, you know, you built up these successful businesses. You know, you've taken over industries. You've had many successes. But it doesn't mean that you've reached your full potential. And that I felt linked into identity a lot, because even throughout the book, especially towards the business chapter, I do touch on the fact that I feel you really need to know yourself as a person and understand your purpose in order to, you know, work effectively. And again, it wasn't until I wrote this book that I really realized I actually didn't know myself. Now I feel much more grounded and confident, but before I wrote this book, I actually didn't know who Jeremiah was. So I hope that chapter, when it comes to reading it, will be very, very like impactful and interesting.
Well, growing up, you just seemed like a really nice bloke. And then, but you were, it's not like you weren't mixing with people who, as you put it, were taking the wrong path.
Yeah.
And you've got voices in the book. One of the experiences you share in the book is really cleverly, well, I was probably having a really good editor or somebody, but I'm sure it was your idea to weave the narrative and the voices into the narrative of your story from other voices. The one of the other voices is Daryl, And his account of being attacked.
Yeah.
And his new car. I mean, it's very honest as well in how he describes himself before that and after. Yeah. And that's how you met. Can you describe what happened and how you became friends with Daryl? It's not how most people meet.
Yeah, no, definitely. Daryl is my best friend. We work on a number of businesses together. We live together now. We just moved into like a brand new house. But the way we met each other was just totally mind-blowing. So Daryl was always a good guy, never involved in crime, nothing to do with gangs or whatever. And one day he had received the keys to his new car. He was told there was like a party that was going on, and some of his friends invited him to come down. So he drove about 40 minutes from his house to get to the party. At the same time, within that week, back in the day, I was an army cadet. So a fun fact that not many people know, I was actually supposed to like go to Sandhurst to become a commissioned officer to like join the army. But I felt like I could impact the world a bit more through the work that I was doing. And that's why I decided not to like go forward and join. But I was in the army cadets, and all that week we were preparing for a first aid competition, which was on a Saturday. And on Thursday evening, I'd had practice, gone home. And the next day, my next door neighbor happened to be having this party on a Friday. So I decided to go to the party as well. And the party was really interesting. It was after exams. Everyone was sort of free. You know, everyone putting their hair down. One of like my biggest childhood crushes was in attendance. Like, I made sure that, you know, I wore the best attire and that.
New Nikes.
New Nikes, everything. And what had happened is that I had left my neighbor's house, gone around the corner, and all I could hear was screaming and shouting. And then I could hear glass shattering. And then, loads of people screaming. So I ran round the corner back in front of my house to find out what was going on. And a young lady came up to me to tell me that someone had been bottled in a fight. So I had walked towards the commotion. I had seen a guy sort of standing up and like weaving about like he was about to faint. But something was odd, and that was that he was like bleeding heavily from like his chest area. He was wearing a white t-shirt. So I had run over and immediately just tried to find out what was going on. Some of my neighbors were like helping him out, but they were literally using tissues and napkins to stem the flow of bleeding. And then when I finally got involved and introed myself, I found out that this young man wasn't bottled, but he was stabbed in about five different places. And this was like right on my doorstep, like literally 5 meters away from my front door. So when it happened, it was an intense like situation. Immediately thought about all of the skills that I had learned within army cadets. And it was good because we always like practice trauma incidents. But at the same time, I was sort of overwhelmed and in a lot of shock, because I couldn't believe that I actually had to use the skills. Like, I thought I would probably never have to use them. And no first aid kit. So we had to literally, I had to call for everyone's clothes, like belts, hoodies, like to just sort out the situation. And then to keep the young man awake, I had to like, I remember saying to him, do you like music? He was like, yeah. I was like, what were you listening to this morning? He said, Stormzy, Shut Up. I was like, the worst song to pick, because now I need to ask him to sing it along with me. So literally at that moment, I had to get Daryl to recite Shut Up by Stormzy. So man tries to say he's better than me to tell my man Shut Up. And it was the most inappropriate song in that moment. But yeah, it kept Daryl awake. And then before he went into the ambulance, I had called my phone from his phone. And then went back into the house, into my neighbor's house. Her mum had helped me like get rid of all the blood. And then, you heard my mum burst through the doors. Oh, Jeremiah, where are you? And then I ended up back in my house, remembering, oh, I've got a first aid competition in the morning. And then it did really affect me. Like, everything started to kick in, especially when I tried to get to sleep. I was contacting Daryl and I heard nothing all night, and it was like devastating because I just wanted to know that he was all right. And there's almost like this bond that is created, even though that individual is a stranger, you've never known them before, you just have all of this like almost like love for them, like you want to make sure they're okay. And then finally in the morning I received a text saying that, you know, he was fine, everything was good, and then I had a massive sigh of relief. And then the way we sort of connected following that, I think Daryl had connected with me on social media, and I would have still been 16 at the time. And then he would like see me one day with like Grimmy and Rita Ora, like the Teen Awards stuff, and then Tiny Temper is one of my mentors, so I'll always be around Tiny. And then on my birthday, my 17th birthday, he popped up to me saying, oh my god, you're only 17. And then I invited him to a barbecue. He's about 3 years older than me, so I invited him to a barbecue with Tiny's label Disturbing London. And then from there on we just became best friends. And like the irony of it is that there's so many people that work with us, engage with us on a day-to-day basis, and they actually don't know like the backstory. It's just something we don't really talk about. But we did end up doing a documentary, a radio documentary on Radio One. But the book, we felt it was a really important story to tell. You know, it's that whole sliding doors thing, that film from back in the day, you know, how one moment could change your life. You know, in a way, I felt that Daryl had saved me because my whole entire outlook on life had changed. I became more grateful, you know, filled with gratitude. I sort of interacted with my mum very differently and my family. And moving forward, I just live my life knowing that tomorrow isn't promised.
Another character that we meet in the book and who contributes to the book is Carl. Now, Carl could have been one of the guys who were attacking your mate Daryl at one point in his life.
Yeah.
And he describes so eloquently he calls it traumatic and romantic, the appeal of violence.
Yeah.
The absoluteness of it. And I'd never heard it described in that way before. It really opened my eyes and my mind to it. Is that what you see, like almost like a siren call, almost like a temptation growing up in the atmosphere that you're talking about? How do you choose not to go down that route, especially as a young man? I mean, you follow basically what you're tempted to, don't you?
Or
what you see as romantic and exciting. Yeah. Tell us about Carl and how did he get out of that way of life?
Yeah. So Carl Loco is one of my earliest mentors. He's a former gang leader. And I would say like at a point he was like one of the most notorious like gangsters in Britain, like hands down. Like the gang that he ran was always in the papers, like all around like Brixton and South London. And his life transformation is so inspirational because he was someone that was feared by all to who became someone who was loved by many. And the fact he was able to turn his life around was just so inspirational because it's so hard when you're so fixated within a certain lifestyle to rehabilitate and to completely change your mindset. Carl is now, he runs a non-profit. He's an advisor to Prince Harry on Youth. He's one of the people that introed me to the Bransons because he done a lot of work with them around gang reform and education. And all round well good guy. And the reason Carl inspired me is because, and when we talk about gangsterism, starting off with, young people who are in gangs don't see it as a gang. They see it as a group of friends who have come together. Like even a question, Richard, what football team do you support?
Leeds United.
Okay, cool. Why do you support Leeds?
Because I was born there.
You were born there. So in a similar way, many young people who actually get involved in gangs, It's almost like inherited. It's something that they're almost like born into. And I know so many young people who grew up in an area, and sometimes it's even forced upon you because it's almost this continuous cycle. You know, certain areas don't get along with each other, and it's just history. And to many young people, by the time you get to 11 or 12 and you're taking that journey to school, that's when the stark reality kicks in that maybe you have to take a different route because you might bump into a certain person, or, you know, if someone stops you on the road and asks you where you're from, you might not be able to say your area. So it's something that just comes naturally and so complex, and we could actually talk out all day about how it works and how it gets to there. But in terms of violence itself, violence has been here from the beginning of time. You know, in the medieval times, every single person that walked around had a sword on their side, you know. So if we're talking about violence and whatever, and wars and whatever, and even just gang violence, you know, there was even a massive problem within Scotland. And I'll talk on that a bit later, because they done a fantastic thing to turn it around. Yeah, in Glasgow, to turn it around. So yeah, in terms of Carl, the reason he was very inspirational to me, he changed his life around, but within the book I asked him a very specific question, and that is, you know, Carl, you've turned your life around. You know, I see you with Prince Harry, I've seen you on Necker Island with Richard Branson, you know, I've seen you with all of these incredible people, I've seen the impact that you've had in your community. Why is it that some of the people that were in the same gang as you 10 years ago are still involved in gangsterism? And what he said to me is, it's down to perception, and it's whatever you perceive as success. And I've had this conversation a countless amount of times, whether it be with like my team, or across my businesses, or whether it be with young people that I've mentored. And it's the fact that whatever you perceive as success is where you're going to aspire to go in the future. And to many young people, again, down to the whole inequality debate, growing up within certain communities across the UK, you know, it isn't necessarily a race thing. We see forms of inequality everywhere. For many young people, their forms of success, well, in my sort of experience, you know, a gangster with a gold chain, with a nice Rolex watch and a nice car. And that, to a lot of young people, is the only success they've seen, because their families, no one from their family has ever gone to university. You know, their parents, or one of their parents, if it's a single parent home, might have to work two jobs. So in terms of like success around them, that is the only form of success they see. So if a young person is in an environment and that is the only form of success they see, that is what they'll aspire to be. Because even at a certain point in my life, before I knew someone like Carl, and even though I had started very young in terms of the work I was doing, to me, there was a point that was the only form of success I was seeing. So to many young people, if that is the only form of success, that is what they'll aspire to be. And Carl said the reason why me and him were different is because we had different forms of success that we had little peaks, just little peaks of seeing. So even when I was doing all of my youth politics, and I'll be able to go into Parliament, or I'm being invited to 10 Downing Street, or I'm sitting down with Lord Bernard Hogan Howell, just all of these like decision makers. These are forms of success that I'm seeing now, and it's completely different. So the form of success I would have seen before, I'm not interested in that form of success. And one thing we touch on is the fact that if young people, especially those who get involved in gangs and violent crime, actually had mentors and people that they could look up to who were successful in a positive way, then that is what they'll aspire to be. They won't get involved in all of their illegal activity and stuff that they do. And I think the second thing to quickly touch on that we speak about in the business chapter is a concept that me and Carl discussed and created called the hidden alumni. And we felt within society there were so many individuals who had incredible skills who were using them for the wrong reasons. So where I'm from, there was three examples I used, which were selling drugs, fraud, and being in a gang. At the age of 11, I would be able to name you every single key gang member in all of the areas that I lived around. Had I met any of them? No. So how did I know their name? And realistically, when I thought about it, it's because they're some of the greatest marketers in the country, because at the end of the day, they create their gang name. A lot of the time, gangs across London have been reinvented. So they rebrand their names. You know, they create all these logos, do music and all of this stuff. So the fact that I was 11 and I can name you every single one, doesn't that go to show that some of the young people involved in that are great marketers? Or even talking about like drug dealers and young people that sell drugs, you know, again, a very illegal and negative thing to do. But in order to sell drugs effectively, you have to build up your contact list of people. And me and Carl were discussing that, sort of saying, well, they must be good to be in like a sales team of like a corporate company, surely. And all of these skills that we see, especially through the Hidden Alumni, we just always used to discuss, how can we get all of these young people to reinvent themselves and to use some of these skills in a positive way? And again, a lot of them would end up in prison and in the justice system. And if we're talking about rehabilitation, for us, we were exploring ways that we can convert those skills so that the majority of these young people that go through the criminal justice system don't end up reoffending, which is something that happens to the majority of people that go in. It's just a continuous cycle.
What's the solution to things, activities like stop and search, which you've been subject to? And you talk about in the book, you know, one minute you're at number 10, the next minute you've been bundled into the back of a van.
Yeah.
I mean, not most people, that would make anyone really angry.
Yeah.
But how do you channel that into a solution? Is there a solution? Because you've grown in your experiences, you've got to know people on the police side who are good, who are trying to do good, and so you've got a more balanced view of things.
But yeah,
you're at the receiving end of some.
Yeah, no, it's so funny because the juxtapositions, especially in the book, you know, I start the book by talking about a day I was in Downing Street. I was about 15. I'm having like a reception with David Cameron and all of these other community leaders. And then a couple of days later, I end up in the back of a police van because I fit a description. And, you know, we can say at the end of the day, the police have a job to do. But at the same time, we can't pretend like there isn't a problem. And when it comes to the debate of stop and search, for me, it isn't that stop and search shouldn't exist. It's obviously effective. But I just feel it should be more intelligence-led as opposed to, let's stop someone because the way they look, they're highly, there's a high probability that they're going to be a criminal. You know, I talk about the fact that growing up, majority of the time, me and my friends would play a countdown game. And when we would see the territorial support group, the TSG, go past on the other side of the road, or if it goes past us, we would literally count the amount of seconds it would take for them to turn around. And the majority of the time, it would be like probably less than 20, maybe even 10 seconds. And again, you know, there's all of these debates about, yeah, but the stop was conducted properly and da 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 da. But at the end of the day, if you're growing up in an area and you're constantly just being stopped, then how does that feel? And again, to me, it was normal. The way I saw it growing up is, yeah, the police have a job to do. Sometimes I might just let them search me and do whatever. Sometimes I might exercise my rights and talk, but when you do that, the majority of the time they give you a harder time because they just don't like people that understand the law and whatever, and they really make your life hard if you start mentioning, oh, what's your badge number, what's your grounds for the search. So yeah, it's a really difficult one. So for me, it's really making sure that things are intelligence led, and you know, like I give the example of meeting Inspector Sims, who was a guy from my area, a police officer. And every summer across London, and it was really, really bad during the quarantine period, where all of these like block parties and street parties and stuff. And obviously, a lot of the time, they can cause disturbances in the area and can be very annoying to residents. But at the same time, at the very beginning, to say the least, it is very like a very good way to bring the community together and to get people together. Obviously, wrong to do it during the quarantine period. So I attended one of these about 2 or 3 years ago in the area that I grew up in. The police were called down to disperse it. And Inspector Sims's argument was, you know, we're here to keep everyone safe. You know, we've been given intelligence that people could come over here to cause trouble. And to the young people, it was the fact that, you know, they didn't see it as anyone causing trouble. There was no one running up and down doing anything bad. You know, they were doing this anti-knife crime event and they just didn't understand why the police wanted to stop it. And the way I saw it is, you know, I'm speaking to Inspector Sims, who has a very valid point, and then he's turning around saying, well, they should have obtained a license from the council. And I'm turning around to the young people who, again, their point is, okay, we could have gone to the council and stuff, but we don't understand any of this information. And how do we just pick up the phone? Do we just pick up the phone and to the reception of Lambeth Council and ask them if we can put on an event? And my middle ground was that at the end of the day, the police had a job to do. The young people saw it as something peaceful they were doing. Why don't we just get police and communities to work together if it is a license that they need, rather than just shutting it down? And now you've got young people who are all in a safe space, who now are going to disperse to loads of different places. Some of them who might commit crimes and stuff wouldn't have been doing it at that time, but now they've left the area and they could bump into someone, all of this stuff. So rather than allowing that to happen, why don't we as a community come together? And if it is a license that they need, why don't you tell them what they need to do to obtain a license? Why don't you help them plan the event so it has risk assessments and everything's put in place to make sure that it doesn't go wrong, to make sure that there's security and everyone's safe? And that for me was like a point where I saw two opposing views directly in front of me. You know, I'm speaking to a senior police officer, and then at the same time I was speaking to one of like the elders on the area. And the way I saw it was, how can that middle ground be found? Which was like super, super important for me.
And finding that middle ground, you know, there's a reason why people are congregating, or apart from just wanting to have a good time, is that they've got nowhere else to go. And
yeah,
you talk about austerity in the book and the 70% cuts,
yeah,
to, you know, Lambeth's youth services in austerity.
Yeah,
it's not going to get any better, is it? With
no,
what would you do? I mean, A, what do you think about the current lot in power? Because David Cameron almost seems like a wistful romantic.
Yeah, yeah. Now,
you know, a sort of softer times. But what do you think about the current lot in power? And what would you do faced with these decisions? Because it's, you know, uneasy lies the head that wears the crown.
Yeah.
You've got to make decisions and have priorities. What would be your priorities if you were... And, you know, it's not unreasonable to think that you will be influencing people and policymakers anytime soon. But what would you do? What would your priorities be?
So first of all, in regards to like the cuts and stuff, growing up, there was practically nowhere to go, like nowhere. So it was either that your local youth club was shut down, or that the ones that remained open, their services were like drastically reduced. So between the age of like 11 to 15, our youth club became McDonald's in Brixton Town Centre. And again, the most unhealthy environment to be in, open to the public. But for us, it was a safe space. And there were certain days that I would go to the McDonald's to remain there for hours on hours after school, because there was practically nothing else to do. And again, even in terms of food and stuff, for many of us to even get a hot meal, we would just save our little pocket money of like £2 a day or whatever to go to the McDonald's and buy something. So these are things that young people still have to face. In terms of politics, I've been quite apolitical because of a lot of the charitable work that I do. But the majority of the issues that young people are going through now, it hasn't happened overnight. It isn't just when a new government comes in, it all goes down the drain. You know, we've had many different governments in the past like 20 years or so, and many of these issues are still ongoing. Youth violence is still a massive issue that was affecting people 20 years ago, and it's still affecting communities now. I feel in terms of politicians, you know, it's just about waking up to realities. And at the end of the day, sometimes I feel it isn't arrogance. Maybe a few people are actually disillusioned and don't actually, they're not really aware about some of these issues to the extent that they're ongoing within society. You know, 95% of the stories that I share within the book probably never ever made the news. So to think that a politician's going to really delve into an issue like youth violence or an issue like a young person going to a youth club, it probably won't come too close to that. And I feel like personal experiences, like I don't feel, you know, our representation in government is diverse enough. Like it just isn't diverse, gender-wise, race-wise, you know, more work needs to be done. And until you have like loads of different views and loads of different experiences in a place of power, then many of the policies that are shaped are only going to, you know, impact particular groups.
Yeah. And it's socioeconomic backgrounds as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because you can have a diverse cabinet of different race and different genders, but they might all have gone to the same school.
So diversity, diversity to me isn't necessarily down to race. It is definitely like socioeconomic background as well. And again, throughout the book, I talk about inequality, but a lot of the time when we talk on issues like violent crime and stuff in the UK, when I speak to a lot of people, I'm interviewed, like it's seen as like a black problem. You know, I talk about the fact there's 1.2 million black people in London, and in a really, really bad, terrible year, let's say that 50 perpetrators of murder were black. That is 0.004% of the entire population within London. And in comparison to a place like Glasgow, it's just not multicultural at all. In 2005, it had, you know, a complete population of 600,000. At that time, they had like nearly 200 murders in 1 year. So again, it just goes to show it isn't necessarily a race thing. And again, within government and places of power, we need people who are from different sort of backgrounds. When I say background, again, down to socioeconomic background. So there's someone on my team called Nicola. Nicola's amazing. She helps us with PR on our record label, and she grew up in Middlesbrough, and up there, like it was just so deprived for her. Like even on her last day of school, a student burned down the whole school. Like it was crazy for her to live up there. And many of the experiences that I have had, we've both shared. It isn't necessarily down to just race, as you rightly mentioned, because again, I know many people who look like me who have gone to Eton and have gone to Harrow, and their parents have been able to afford like their tuition fees and stuff. So it's definitely the question around how can we create this country a more equal society.
Are we in a better place than we were? Because a lot of people say, you hear it in the right-leaning press, you know, the Black Lives Matter centres backwards, you know, everybody's angry with each other. But people were always angry with each other, weren't they? People sort of had the idea that we'd made progress. As a young person in Britain today, seeing it from your perspective as somebody who's going to be impacted by all the decisions made, including Brexit, etc., are you optimistic about the future? After the last 6 months, after all the venting of anger, are you glad that these issues are more out in the open, that we can talk about stuff a bit more? Or where
feel do you stand on it? The first step is definitely communication and conversation and talking about these issues. I feel a lot of the time we sort of jump to conclusions saying, what is the solution? Where, to be honest, we should just be discussing why the problems exist in the first place. And then maybe after you discuss it, you'll find the solutions. In terms of if things are better, you know, it depends what we're talking about. You know, again, my family was homeless for 7 years, and within that time, I didn't even realize we were homeless. I just thought, if anything, I thought we were wealthy because we moved seven different houses. Yeah. So at the end of the day, you know, it's still a problem that is ongoing. You know, some of the residents of Grenfell are still in temporary accommodation. You know, we can look at free school meals, and they're still on the rise, and a rise in the use of food banks. And, you know, if it wasn't for excellent campaigners and individuals like Marcus Rashford during the lockdown period, then many families wouldn't have been able to feed their kids. You know, so are things getting better? Again, in many areas, they're not, because the numbers are just going in the complete opposite direction. And I feel when it comes to politics, it's a very dangerous game, because you can pinpoint different stats and say, oh, but this is improving, or that is improving, or more GCSE results. But there's still ongoing issues that we need to talk about. In terms of like the Black Lives Matter movement, again, Black Lives Matter itself is an organization. I think there's been a miscommunication between the specific organization itself and the whole movement itself, because it's been called the same thing. I think for me, it was just inspiring to see so many people stand up to talk about what they believe in. Again, the question, does racism exist? Definitely yes. Is it still an issue? Yes. I feel a lot of the time, sometimes there's a debate around whether or not racism doesn't exist, or that isn't racist, or we're not a racist society, or whatever. There's more of a debate over that than a debate over how can we eliminate racism. So a lot of the time when I see debates on TV, you know, the arguments, oh, but how is that racist? How does that make that racist? Or how is Stop and Search racist? Or da-da-da. And we can talk about all the time, but at the end of the day, racism still exists. Yeah. So let's stop focusing on whether something's racist or not, and realize that people are still treated differently because of the color of their skin, or down to their beliefs, down to their religion. And I feel we need to start focusing on that a bit more. You know, I talk about my first racist experience, and I don't really speak on race a lot, and I haven't until this book. But I was 10 years old in Glasgow, and I was on a bus and walked on the top deck, and then there was these kids loitering at the back, drinking and smoking on the bus, and I had sat in a seat not too far away from them. And then one of the young women had said something like, move this N-word away from me, or something like that, just randomly just said it. And I was like 9 or 10 years old, just hearing this. And I didn't fully understand what it had meant, but my mum quickly got up and then took me away, and then had a conversation with the young people. And one of the girl's friends had actually stood up and said, no, you like, why would you say something like that, and whatever. And it wasn't until I grew older, or even from that point, I had realised that I was going to be treated in a certain way and looked at differently because of the colour of my skin. And it was something that I just couldn't avoid. And to experience that at such a young age, again, when there's all of these debates around racism, and again, the debate is more lean towards, is this racist, or that doesn't mean that that person was treated racist. You know, for me, it's that 10-year-old Jeremiah. How can we make sure that doesn't happen to another 10-year-old? That another 10-year-old doesn't have to be on a bus in a completely different place they haven't been to before, and someone calls them a derogatory word due to the colour of their skin. And that's what I think is super, super important.
Yeah, there's no point denying it exists or not. It's looking at it and seeing, well, where did it come from? Yeah. Where's it going, and how can you redirect it or just get rid of it?
Exactly.
Well, listen, spending time in my head with you, as I have done the last couple of days, it's been a real pleasure. It hasn't been a nightmare at all, but it's been a real pleasure sharing with you. Ladies and gentlemen, Jeremiah Emanuel.
Thank you so much.
Dreaming in a Nightmare. inequality and what we can do about it
is available to buy now. Just follow the link in the description of the podcast. And if you'd like to be the first to hear and meet the brightest minds behind the smartest new nonfiction, sign up to our monthly most wanted email at bookomi.com. Meanwhile, if you enjoyed this Bookomi podcast, please let us know by following and subscribing on Apple, Spotify, and Google audio platforms. Thanks to Kate at Penguin Random House, Murky Books, Ruby and Maria at Shoreditch House, Rachel Cody for edits, and Jeremiah for his book and his Omi. I'm Richard Kilgariff. Stay safe, wear a mask for the task, and dream big. Bye for now.